Hello and welcome. It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor, and Peg Webb, senior vice president and financial advisor. Welcome to both of you. How are you doing, Peg?
Good. Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Hello, Peg Webb. Hello, Susie Jones. And Susie, today is one of those days that we do every so often where we're going to ask Peg and Bruce anything. So listeners, any and all financial questions for the entire hour. Peg and I don't have any specific issues, any specific topic or agenda. Listeners get to drive the show. Peg, is there anything forefront, top of your mind, though, things going on in your world that you want to start the ball rolling with?
Yeah, as listeners know, they can start texting or calling in with questions. But I wanted to go back, Bruce, because it actually was two different radio shows that we did recently about inherited IRAs. And so this actually went then to our financial planning department within Wealth Enhancement Group to get a kind of a summary of what happens when somebody passes away and you become a beneficiary. What are those rules? Well, before 2019, and I know it seems like a long time ago now, everybody had the ability, if they inherited an IRA or a Roth IRA, that they had to do what's called required minimum distributions. They had to take a distribution out, but they could stretch it over their whole lifetime. So in some cases, Bruce, our clients were 30, 40 years, you know, still before they passed away. So they had all this time to take out money out of that IRA, and sometimes it was just smaller amounts. Well, then the IRS came back and said, because in the Secure Act, they said, wait a minute, we need to collect more money from all these people sooner than later when people pass away. So they came out with this ruling that said you had to liquidate the account in 10 years. Now, right away, they said that doesn't apply to your spouse. So if you inherit as a spouse, you still have these long-term features that you can take out required minimum distributions. But it's more so, let's say if it's your children, your grandchildren that you left it to, they want to be able to collect that money sooner. So what they came up with was this 10-year rule. Well, that was over a year ago. Since 2019, they needed clarification. Like, what does that really mean? Does that mean that if I inherit an IRA, I can wait until the day before the 10 years is up and just liquidate it? So there was a lot of confusion around that. So now what the IRS said was, no, you have to take out a required minimum distribution over that 10 years. You can't wait till that last day. But you still have the privilege of pulling out more money than the IRS is requesting of you, but you can take out more at any time. So there's a lot more clarification around that. And we have had a couple questions, Bruce, on that in the last couple of weeks. But I would talk to your tax advisor or your financial planner, even if it hasn't happened to you yet, but you feel like, oh, I might inherit some money. We try to incorporate that into the financial plan. Some people want us to already incorporate that in. Some clients say, do not put that in because I don't even know if I'm really the beneficiary on that account. Bruce?
Well, and I'm glad you clarified this, Peg, and I know we've had a lot of questions, and I know there's been confusion, and I probably contributed to the confusion because probably even on this show, I might have said, if you want to wait till the end of the 10-year window and take it all out at once, you can, because I honestly thought that was the way it works. So this clarification is not only for listeners and clients, it's for me because I was getting it wrong. I misunderstood the way it works. So I appreciate you giving me and everybody else clarity on that.
Well, anything part of that, too, one other thing, Bruce, that I failed to mention is If the deceased was already in required minimum distribution status, like they were already taking RMDs, then you have those rules. But if the owner hasn't started your required minimum distribution, you can still wait and take it till the end of that 10 years. So they're allowing people, and they're thinking about people that are under 73, you know, required minimum distribution, that why do we want them to have to take it out? You have more control about your distribution. So I failed to mention that in the beginning.
Well, I'm glad you clarified again. So not to be redundant, not to belabor the point, I guess I was actually right, because we have to differentiate. So you inherit an IRA, and the first thing we have to look at is, was the owner of the IRA that you received it from, were they already at the age where they had to take required minimum distributions? And if the answer is yes, you must continue with at least that much withdrawn every year. But if they passed away before they reached the age of required minimum distribution and you inherit, then the law says you have to deplete the value of the account over a 10-year period of time. You can do it all at once in the beginning, all at once at the end, one-tenth every year. You've got a lot more flexibility if that person that left you the IRA that you inherited from had not yet reached the age of required minimum distribution, correct?
That is absolutely correct, yes.
Then I had it right.
Mm-hmm. Good job.
Susie, anything coming in?
Yeah. Let's get to them. 651-461-9226. Again, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, along the same lines as inheriting IRAs, can you speak to inheriting annuities? Thank you.
So, Peg, I guess the first thing we should clarify is that an annuity can be a qualified annuity, meaning it's in a retirement plan like an IRA, or it can be a non-qualified annuity, meaning it's just it's outside of any kind of retirement plan. And in terms of whether it's in an IRA or not, it's going to work a little bit differently. Peg?
Yeah, so non-qualified is where people have taken after-tax money and they put it into an annuity as an investment vehicle, and the earnings on that non-qualified annuity are deferred, kind of similar to a taxable IRA. Well, if you have a non-qualified, you don't have required minimum distributions. You don't have to start taking withdrawals. You have the privilege of, you know, cashing it in. Now think about this. The money that people invested in this non-qualified annuity, that was after-tax money. So let me give you an example. If you started out with $25,000, you used after-tax money to buy this annuity, then, and it doubled in money. So there's $25,000 now earnings in that account. You can cash it out as a beneficiary. You can take it out over time, things like that. Now, if it was an annuity in an IRA, which a lot of people do, they buy annuities inside their IRA, then you have to follow the IRS guidelines as far as taking those required minimum distributions, you know, similar to what I just talked about on the whether it's a spouse or whether it's a daughter, son, or grandchildren, that kind of thing. Bruce?
Yeah, the only thing I would add, that was really good. Sometimes I get the question, why would anybody put an annuity in an IRA? Because they ask the question, I think, under the assumption that the motivation to invest in an annuity in the first place is to get the tax deferral, which is already there in an IRA. They're like, well, it's like putting a belt on when you're already wearing suspenders. You don't need it. But annuities can bring other advantages to the investor besides just tax deferral. Now, in fairness, annuities can also have some disadvantages, and the investor needs to understand before they make that investment, what are the advantages and what are the disadvantages? And for me, as an investor, do the advantages outweigh the disadvantages so that I want to do this or not? The other thing, Peg, in terms of advantages, I just wanted to mention, and since the texter was specifically asking about inheriting, annuities always have what the annuity company calls a death benefit. I don't like that term because I think it makes people think life insurance when you talk about a death benefit. But all it means is, generally, is that an investor in an annuity has assurances that their survivor or their beneficiary can never get less than what they started with. I might say the more apt terminology is die in a down market clause. So if your annuity is investing in the market, which is called a variable annuity, and the market goes down, let's say somebody invested $100,000 and the market goes down and now the account balance is $80,000 and that person passes away, the death benefit or die in a down market clause assures that the beneficiary will still get $100,000 even though that account dropped in value. That is one of the possible advantages that people might be looking at when they consider investing in an annuity, because you wouldn't get that same return of your original investment in funds or individual stocks or things like that. So the idea that I should never invest a tax-deferred annuity in an IRA isn't true. You might have different motivations for investing in that annuity besides just the tax deferral. Susie?
651-461-9226, 651-461-9226. A couple of questions wondering about the Trump, the new bill, the new law with a lot of tax implications in it. Will it affect Social Security this year? That's one texter. And are there any significant parts of the new law that will impact seniors in retirement? I know, Bruce, you mentioned perhaps having a show on that when we have people that have gone through it, but maybe there's a little more you can offer. Peg, Bruce?
Yeah, thank you, Susie Jones. So, Peg, again, for listeners that might not know, just literally a weekend ago, so like, you know, 8, 9, 10 days ago, the big, beautiful bill was signed into law. It's not a bill anymore. It's now law. It was passed in the Congress and in the Senate. President Trump signed it. Last week, we gave some of the headlines with a promise that as we dig into this 900-page monster a little deeper, we'll come back with some more specifics. Peg, any other key headlines that you've been able to ascertain or anything you think is something we should add clarity to after last week at this point? I know we're not ready to do an entire show on this yet, but any other additional insights that you can share with listeners?
Oh, for sure. We have had another week. And what's interesting about it, and this is the Peg Webb opinion, it's actually quite simplified. It actually is. I don't know what's in this 870-page document, but what came out of it was quite a bit of simplification, meaning the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act from 2017, that's probably the biggest, that was a big change. And what they decided to do is to keep the tax rates as is. So they're not going to change those different levels of percentages based on income. So that's that was a change. The other thing is they just increased the standard deduction. So for couples, married couples filing jointly right now, it's $31,500. So they're enhancing that a little bit. I think this is the biggest item, though, that has a lot of confusion. The law created what's called senior bonus deduction. And I talked about this last week, but I think everybody was confused on what I was talking about. But it's $6,000 for taxpayers ages 65 plus effective in 2025. This is a provision that's temporary and subject to a phase out. But while it's in effect, it has the potential to create a significant tax planning opportunity for seniors. And the reason that they did this, I can't tell you that they told me that this is the reason they did this, but remember how they were kind of touting that they were not going to tax Social Security anymore. That was kind of part of the news, the lead up to what might happen. So this is kind of what I would call like a Band-Aid that they're going to give 6,000 ages 65 and over this reduction, and that supposedly is supposed to kind of offset some of your taxes that you pay on your Social Security. So that was a big one. Other than that, you know, for people who itemize, they raise that state and local tax cap to $40,000. That's kind of big because it was $10,000 and now it's $40,000. If your income's over $500,000, which isn't a lot of people, but if it is, then it kind of eliminates that. And then the other thing is within our business is the death tax. And the death tax, what they ended up doing was that also was part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And they decided to make it an even $15 million per person if you die with that, won't have some additional what we call estate taxes at the end. So that was kind of a change. Now, all of these things that I mentioned, wealthenhancement.com under resources, under radio show. If you scroll down the blog, we have a summary of all the things that I mentioned and many more. So if you're curious and you want to just go read it yourself, Bruce.
Two quick thoughts, Peg. That was a great summation, by the way. That was excellent. I could not have done that as well as you just did it. But the Social Security one, I understand why people are confused because, again, there's scammers. There's stuff out there. I personally have received emails telling me that the part of this law is I'm not going to have to pay taxes on Social Security anymore, and it's not true. And I think it's some attempt by somebody to scam or get information or sell me something, but I've received more than one of those, and it's false. That's not how it works. Peg, you explained it very well how it actually does work. So that's a big one. The other one I wanted to mention is they raised the standard deduction, and I think most filers are still going to be taking a standard deduction rather than itemizing. But some people, because of the increase in the state and local taxes from $10,000 to $40,000, some people that took the standard deduction last year might be able to itemize again with that increase. So if you're close between taking standard deduction or itemizing, you or your tax preparer should take another look at that because that may make a difference. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes this morning, we reached 73 years old and did our RMD and paid the state and federal taxes on the amount, but we each got a fee from the IRS this tax season saying we had not paid enough taxes during the year. We also had moved 403B money to their Roth, paying those taxes in April, not at the time it was transferred. How can we correct this so we don't get a fee in 2026?
Peg, I'm going to guess, and maybe there's more information that we would need, I'm going to guess that the penalty is due to, I'm guessing that the texter files quarterly estimates, and the IRS is probably saying, if you knew you had required minimum distribution, you should have known what your taxes were going to be, and you didn't pay enough in your quarterly estimates. That's the only thing I can think of. Peg, what are your thoughts?
Well, there shouldn't be a penalty when you start required minimum distributions because they always look at the year prior, and then they don't necessarily charge you extra in that first year. So I'm confused about what the problem is. It might have just been some other one-time thing that happened. That's all I can think of.
Yeah, I would tell the texter, if you have a tax preparer, certainly review with them. If you don't have a tax preparer, you know, you can go find somebody, a financial advisor or an accountant, and show them the situation and see if they can help you resolve that. Because I'm not sure why there would be a penalty for that. I agree, Peg. I'm lost. Okay. Susie, we have time to squeeze in one more this
sure.
half of the show.
I think so. My wife and I are 68. We currently withdraw 4% annually from our 401k. Will we have to take out more than the required minimum distribution? And how do you calculate that amount?
So, Peg, it's really an RMD question. How much do people have to take when they have to take RMD?
Well, the IRS has a table that tells you how much you have to take. And actually, it's a little less than 4% at 73 years old. So I think you're going to be okay in the beginning, but then it actually creeps up as you get older. So the percentage will get grander. Hopefully that kind of gives you some insight. But you can look at the IRS table now already and see at the age of 73 what percentage they take out.
Yeah, it's a mortality calculation. The older you get, the higher the percentage is because the less years you have to live and the less years, you know, the IRS has to collect. But a quick note here, Peg, our clients at Wealth Enhancement, we automatically tell them when they have to take an RMD, how much they have to take, and if they have multiple IRAs, where they should take it from every year. It's one of the reasons why for a lot of people to simplify their life and make sure they get it right, they can consolidate these things under one roof. And that's just standard operating procedure that our clients never have to worry about it. We take care of that for them.
And
Susie?
Bruce, that's at 73 years old, right, that you have to take your first RMD?
Correct.
Okay, good. We have more questions. We'll get to as many as we can in the second half. One question is it best to open a 529 for grandchildren through my advisor? Let's talk about 529s and grandchildren after on the second half of the program. This is your money. You can jump in anytime and call 651-461-9226. You can certainly call as well, 651-461-9226. And we are back for the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer and Peg Webb. And this is the number to call or text, 651-461-9226. This particular program, we're calling Ask Bruce and Peg Anything. So before we jump into the question about 529s, do you guys want to reset the stage a little bit or jump right in?
Peg, anything you want to hit on?
No, I'm ready.
All right, 529s. Is it best to open a 529 for my grandchildren through an advisor, or can I do it on my own? The question is.
Great. Hey, Peg, talk maybe a little bit for listeners that might not know what the texter's referring to when they talk about a 529.
Yeah, 529 is a vehicle that's actually issued by states. So Minnesota has one. All, you know, of the states have a 529. The idea behind it is to save money. It originally originated as save money for college. That was kind of the theme of it. Since they came out, there's all sorts of extra ways that you can invest in 529s and utilize them for. Now they'll allow you to do in-home teaching where people kids don't even go to school. But there's all sorts of things you can do, K through 12 now. They've expanded all the uses of this 529. The greatest benefit of the 529 is you take some after-tax money, you deposit it into the 529, and if you follow the rules, it's going to grow tax-free. And your distributions will be tax-free, once again, if you follow the rules of why you're utilizing that money. The other reason that people like them is it's something then that's dedicated. A lot of our clients will buy them for their grandchildren, and or they encourage the parents to buy them, and our clients will gift, you know, their kids to go open a 529. There's lots of rules around how much you can contribute in a particular year. Probably a good time just to talk about the gifting. We deal with a lot of clients that want to gift to this 529. So we can gift to anyone $19,000 in 2025 without having to report that to the IRS. And with a 529, you can do 5 years worth up front. That's somewhere around $95,000 that you could do in 2025. So I like them. I like the fact that it has this tax-free component. there's something new, too, in the tax bill, that the beautiful bill, the big, beautiful bill that just came out, that has to do with it's called a Trump account. And it's a traditional IRA for children. So there's more options, even as of last week, that we have to kind of dive into and see, is that better than a 529? Is it similar? That kind of thing. But just heads up that there is something in the bill about children's education. Bruce?
Yeah, a couple additional thoughts on 529s. Nice job, Peg. Not all 529s are created equally. As Peg mentioned, every state has one. And I think the texter said, how do I go about doing this? What are the logistics if I want to open one? You can open one a lot of different places. You can probably do it on your computer online at home. But knowing which one to pick or what the good ones are is a little trickier. And that's where someone like a financial advisor may come in. I can tell you, I live in the state of Minnesota. I know we have clients all over the country and listeners all over the country, but a lot of my clients live in the state of Minnesota. If someone came in today and wanted a 529 plan, I probably would not recommend the state of Minnesota's plan. There's some other plans from other states that I think the underlying investment options for the investor are better than what the state of Minnesota has. So if you want help navigating those waters to try to pick the best one you can, you might want to seek out professional guidance. The other thing is that I like about the 529s, in some ways they're restrictive, but in some ways they offer flexibility. For example, what if you invest in a 529 with a grandchild or somebody in mind who's going to be the recipient of that money for their education, and they end up not pursuing an education, or they get a full scholarship and they don't need the money, you can change the beneficiary. And in fact, and Peg also talked about the liberal definition, it used to be just for college, now they've expanded that definition to quote unquote higher education. I had a client once, Peg, that set it up for a grandchild. Grandchild didn't need it. The client changed, put themselves on as the beneficiary, and got tax-free withdrawals to go out and get a master gardener designation. And it was totally legal, totally worked. So the 529 that he originally intended, he ended up using it in a way completely different, ended up using it for himself to get adult education as a gardener, and still didn't have to pay any taxes on the gain. So there is some flexibility in these things. But I think trying to get it by yourself might not be the best idea. I would see a financial advisor to help you set that up and make sure you do it as efficiently as possible. Susie?
All right, very good. 651-461-9226. That is a number you can call or text. 651-461-9226 if you have questions for Bruce or Peg. This texter writes, "Hi, is crypto a good thing to invest in? Also, is it a good idea to use my advisor for my 401k? By the way, they say, great show." So maybe start with crypto. I know that's a lot of people wonder about that.
Peg, so we're getting a lot of questions, and thank you, texter listener, for the compliment. We're getting a lot of questions on crypto, cybercurrency, Bitcoin, et cetera, et cetera. Your thoughts first, Peg.
Well, I personally don't follow it that much. I mean, I follow it. I know about it. But at Wealth Enhancement Group, correct me if I'm wrong, but we do not invest in crypto at this point in time. I don't know. Do you know something different, Bruce? I'm personally not utilizing it.
I don't know if there might be some exposure to it in some of the managed portfolios, but yeah, we don't sell individual cyber currency, or you can't come to Wealth Enhancement and buy Bitcoin, but it might be in some of our portfolios. I'm not sure it's not, Peg.
Yeah, we would have to research that, and we can always come back next week.
I know you said, Bruce, once upon a time that you thought that crypto might one day have a real place in our monetary system. Do you still think that's true?
Yeah, so Susie, I think what really is driving this question more than anything else is people that realize that the traditional money that we all use is only money because we say it is. We can say anything is money. There was a time going back, generations where there was no money. They bartered. If you give me that cow, I'll give you two pigs or, whatever. It was a barter system. Money then used to be backed by the gold standard, that we couldn't have more money than we had gold in a vault in Fort Knox. But that hasn't been true since 1972. So money is money because we say it is. Well, we could say that crypto or cyber currency is money. We don't have to have paper money. We can have money that's virtual online. But the problem in terms of investing in it is, and the analogy that I always give, when the automobile was invented, certainly we knew we were not going to go back to horse and buggy as our primary mode of transportation. But that doesn't mean you should go invest in car companies, because there was 130 car companies at one time, and now there's a handful. If you invested in Edsel, you lost all of your money. So I don't know what crypto or what cyber currency might have staying power or be around for a long time. It might be something that hasn't even been invented yet that we haven't heard of yet. So when people tell me they want to invest in this, I tell them that's fine, but I would say it shouldn't be more than 10% of your investable assets, because of the risk involved. If you really want to participate and you can afford the risk, go for it. But don't sell out of all of your other investments and put your life savings in cyber currency or crypto. I just think it's way, way, way too aggressive and too risky. And then, Peg, the second question was 401k and using a financial advisor.
Oh, well, the world is your oyster as far as what you can put in 401, or the options that you have in an IRA or 401k. Even your employer is giving us a lot of depth of what we can pick and that kind of thing. So I just highly recommend that people get help. There's so many choices out there, and to kind of weed through all of them and tailor it for you is hard to do on your own. And I get so many questions, especially from my family, like, what am I supposed to be doing? And I know that they are a percentage of the people out there that really just, the questions I get, I'm like, oh dear, they need help. And I actually don't personally work with my family. I don't, because I don't want to talk about that at holidays. So I recommend another advisor within Wealth Enhancement Group, which they're very happy with. So I'm just saying, I think it's a reason to reach out to somebody other than maybe family and get some advice from a financial advisor.
Yeah, and I would just add really quickly, Peg and Susie, again, I'm not trying to do a commercial or a plug for Wealth Enhancement, but so our clients, it is standard operating procedure that if they want us to, and I don't want to stick my nose in where it's not wanted, but if they want me to review their investment options available to them within their company retirement plan, 401k or whatever it is, we will look at the investment choices. And obviously, we know our client, their goals and objectives, their time horizon, their risk tolerance, their desired rate of return. And at no additional fee, just part of the service that we provide, we will provide them with what we think is an efficient or appropriate asset allocation for them and their 401k. So the idea of using your advisor on your 401k, I think, can be a good idea. Now, different kettle of fish, if that advisor wants to manage your 401k and get paid for it, then you have to make a decision. Are they going to add enough value to increase my returns to offset the cost and give me a better net return? That's a trickier question, but at Wealth Enhancement, it's a standard operating procedure. We just do it. So I don't know why clients wouldn't take advantage of that. And most of my clients do. Susie?
651-461-9226. That is the number to call or text if you have a question for Bruce or Peg. A texter writes, can you convert a 529 to a Roth?
Peg, this question has come up a couple of times, I think, recently, and I don't remember if we answered it or if we never got to it, but whether we did or not, obviously it's still floating out there. So converting a 529 to a Roth IRA, Peg?
I personally have not done it, but I actually believe that it's doable. I think you can take a 529 plan, roll it over to a Roth for a certain beneficiary, but there's a bunch of kind of rules around it. I have not done it, but I think it's worth investigating because if you, with a 529, you know, it's you're using it for a continuing education and all the things that we talked about. But then let's just say you've come to a fork in the road where it you just know you're not going to use it for that, and you don't necessarily want to cash it out and, you know, and have penalties and that kind of thing. So I actually think it's doable. I just don't have that all in the top of my head.
Yeah, it absolutely is doable, but I agree with you, and I'm consistent with you. There's certain hoops that you have to jump through, and there's certain limitations. I also don't have those memorized, but to the texter and to the listeners, yes, it is possible. One of my beefs, if you will, one of my criticisms of 529s historically has been, you know, if you end up not using it for higher education, it's probably a decision that you regret, because even though you still invested money, but if you didn't get the tax advantage, which is really the primary motivation for the 529, then you might have said, I would have had a better return on investment in something other than a 529 since I didn't get the tax advantage, since I didn't use it for higher education. But now, this is a change within recent years, you can convert some of that, if you're not going to use it for education, to a Roth IRA and still get that tax advantage. And it, to me, it made 529s more appealing, more attractive. But yes, I also don't know exactly what the limitations are and the parameters. But the short answer is, yes, it's doable, at least partially. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. The texter writes, prior to the pandemic, we attended an in-person seminar with Wealth Enhancement. Any plans for another one in the future?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I don't know who they saw or what the seminar was, but just to elaborate, Peg, as you know, when the pandemic hit, we went to virtual seminars. We went to webinars or online seminars, and we still do those on occasion, but we are now doing in-person seminars again. But it's interesting. I think, like a lot of things post-pandemic, it hasn't fully gone back to the level that it used to be prior, both in terms of we probably don't do as many as we used to do, and not as many people turn out for them as they used to. But we are doing them again, and we can do seminars or workshops that are for the general public, and they are primarily designed to be educational. Full disclosure and full honesty. We also hope that sometimes those seminars, if those people that attend are not clients of ours, they might consider working with us if we make a favorable impression at the seminar. But we also do a lot of educational events for existing clients that are dedicated at them. So the short answer is we are doing seminars and workshops and public events again, probably not to the extent that we used to, and we'll see, you know, how that comes back and builds back as we get further, you know, the pandemic gets to be farther away in our rearview mirror. Peg, your thoughts?
Yeah, the only thing I would say is on our website, there's nothing posted right now, but it's usually kind of a springtime, fall time that we would do them, because in the summer, people are super busy with taking advantage of the weather.
Yeah, and I personally do a lot of them, and I have speaking engagements every spring and every fall. And yes, not in the summer. People don't want to go in the summer, and I don't want to do them in the summer, and not in the winter, because in Minnesota, you never know what the weather's going to be, and we don't want to have an event and have a blizzard. So, yeah, wealthenhancement.com, there'll probably be stuff posted there pretty soon. We're in July. It wouldn't surprise me if we're doing events, you know, in September and October in the Minnesota. But, all, you know, depending upon where you are in the country, there's events going on For sure in the spring and the fall, and again, they should be listed or posted on our website.
All right, should we try to keep going? We've got another one. The texter writes at 651-461-9226, what is the value of putting your house in a trust versus putting it in a will as a beneficiary designation?
Hey, Peg, you're better at this than I am, but maybe even expand the question, advantages of, you know, and disadvantages, and compare a will to, and when they say trust, they're talking about something called a revocable trust, not just the house, but certainly mention the house or real estate, but talk a little bit about comparing a will and a trust, and I think you're more knowledgeable on that than I am.
Well, I think one of the things is that's become popular is the state that you live in and the county that you live in. I've been encouraging lots of clients just to go because it's new now where you can put your beneficiaries on your house. So that actually helps not having to do something even more complex. I want people to know that. And then if you list your house or in a will or a trust, it's basically just saying, this is what I want with this particular asset. It's not as easy as a stock or a bond or things like that. But having it, I would say if it's complex, I would for sure put it in a trust. If it's not, and you're putting it in a will, check with your county or state to see if you could just fill out a form. That has seemed to work well with our clients.
Peg, when you mentioned just making someone else the beneficiary, is that the same thing as the transfer on death deed or the TODD? Because I know those have largely placed what we used to use, we used to call life estates. Am I thinking of the right thing, or am I mixing up apples and oranges here?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Actually, I'm not sure at this point. There's so many different ways of describing, you know, how to do it. And I still feel like when we meet with clients, we're tailoring it to them. You know, it's not just this broad thing where I tell everybody, you know, to do one thing or the other.
Right. And again, some people should have a trust. Obvious examples would be if you have property in more than one state, if you have a complicated situation, if you value privacy and don't want things to, you know, be public record as part of a probate process. But for the vast majority of people, probably a simple will is sufficient. Susie, I know we're getting close to the end.
We are. We have less than 30 seconds. Great show. Great questions. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of them. There's some great questions this week. And if you did not get your question answered, feel free to jump on and email yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, or you can call 1-888-6-ADVICE at any time and go in for a free consultation. Bruce, Peg, make it a great week. Talk soon.